that you offer what yeah, what about
and everything is gonna break on me now. Yeah. That's what's gonna happen.
Yeah. Yeah, basically. So,
for next meeting.
Actually, that's a good idea.
Another meeting.
We could just have meetings about shrink off meeting people and dance meeting people. So, Manel gave a really good overview of blazar detection with Veritas, and I'm specifically going to talk about more general radio galaxy detection with GEV and TEV. I'm going to talk about the three major type misaligned blazars that have been detected at TEV and what we've learned from the TEV emission and what we've learned from the GEV emission. All of these not only are collaborations between Veritas and Fermi and MAGIC and Hess, and but by many really good scientists around the world. Most of them are in this room and getting the multi-wavelength data that we have. I don't think we would really know what's going on in these objects. We just really can't without doing these gigantic, intensive multi-wavelength campaigns on these things. So Manel already went over this, but basically when I talk about VHE, I'm talking about all these energies above 100 GeV, and this is a necessarily ground-based detection method because we can't get the effective areas we need in space. But when we detect them on the ground using shrink-off techniques, using air or water, you end up with an effective area about the size of a football field. So you're trying to counteract the loss of statistics at these highest energies. This is the only way you're going to do it. And if you look at, like, the strongest TEV object in the sky, SETI, which is the Crab, you're talking about 8 gamma rays a minute when you're looking at it with an array like Veritas. So you're really trying to get as much effective area as you can. There's 3 major arrays operating right now, Veritas, Hess, and MAGIC. I put Veritas first just because I'm biased that way. But upgrades are done or happening on MAGIC 2. They added an extra telescope. I'm sure Robert's going to talk about that. Hess 2 are putting in a gigantic new dish in the center of their array. And so both of these are getting really good effective area now down at the low energy overlapping and Fermi. Veritas is going to have an upgrade soon. They're upgrading their camera to have a better effective area across the energy waveband. And we're really excited about the next generation coming of these types of experiments, like Hawk, which is the next major water shrink-off experiment in the CTA. So this is the VHE sky right now. We've got about 120 VHE sources. You can see the galactic plane right here in this galactic plot. I'm showing the beautiful sky survey that Hess did of the galactic plane where all the different types of sources were detected. And then you see the extragalactic sky, which are mostly all AGN except for a couple of starburst galaxies, M82 and NGC 253. So when you're looking at the extragalactic sky with VHE instruments, you're going to almost always see mostly blazars. But I'm specifically going to talk about the 3 misaligned AGN, CINAE, M87, and NGC 1275 briefly today. And I think all 3 of these have been touched upon at this meeting already, so hopefully I'll say something new. This slide is definitely not new, but it's basically what we want to learn from AGN at VHE energies. And we want to try to understand their emission mechanisms. We want to understand the jet structure, and how the black hole is accreting, whether the emission is leptonic or hadronic, but from looking at some of the plots that Marcus put up and talking to Justin, I don't think we're ever going to figure that out unless we see neutrinos, which hopefully Thomas will talk about. You can learn about the universe as a whole by looking at BVL or quantum gravity. But I think when we're looking at radio galaxies with VHE instruments, we're really trying to understand where the emission is coming from. So you might ask why you only see a handful of these things. Basically, I stole this plot from Teddy Chung. The slide from Teddy Chung, he got the plot from Maria Padovani. But if you plot the Doppler factor versus viewing angle, you see the Doppler factor increasing. Blazars are down here, radio galaxies are here. And so blazars are benefiting from these high Doppler factors and high gamma values. And so you get the Doppler boosting, and you can really see them very well at VHE energies. You do have jet emission possible out here. But if there's less beaming available, and you could possibly see some lobe emission from region outside the core, like we've seen with Centaurus A with the Fermi telescope. And specifically, what we're trying to learn from these radio galaxies is, in terms of modeling, is how well do these fit in with the emission seen from the blazar population and the other AGN we see with telescopes like Veritas has some magic. And are the FR1s the parent population of blazars? And by looking at these things at different viewing angles, we're hoping to understand AGN as a population and not individual objects. And maybe there's some kind of complicated geometry going on where you have to use spine sheaths or some of these other methods people have talked about. And I think we have to emphasize that these joint multi-wavelength campaigns are really important in understanding these questions because these things are highly variable. And a lot of times we can only see them when they're flaring, like in VLAC or in NGC 1275. And without the multi-wavelength coverage, we're not really going to know what's going on. Because not only are they variable, but they are intrinsically multi-wavelength. And we can't just look at the high-energy tail over here and understand what's going on in the whole object. So the first one is NGC 1275, and this one is the radio galaxy at the core of the Perseus cluster. And it was detected in the first 3-month catalog of the LAT, and then they refined the position here with the 11-month localization. And this detection basically says that there's evidence for long-term variability, and we saw the plot earlier where this was detected by COSP probably, not by EGR, but then it was detected by Fermi LAT at a level higher than the EGR upper limit. So it's most likely variable in GEV. And then subsequently, Veritas looked at this for about 10 hours and got this upper limit. And you can see compared to the Fermi spectrum, it most likely means that there's some kind of cutoff here, at least when these observations were taken. This paper by Acciari et al. Basically says that at this point in time, the total SED was not compatible with the straight power law up there. But it's variable. You see there this lat-like curve down here above 800 MeV. You see there's this 2009 flare, and that was seen along with GEV hardening. And then there was this 2010 flare where MAGIC reported the VAG detection. I'm hoping that. And these flares might correlate with some radio flares seen by these might correlate with radio flares. And I think the important key here is it's important to use the radio and the GEV to trigger these TEV observations because back Whipple looked at this object, Veritas has looked at this object, and MAGIC's looked at this object, and only MAGIC has ever seen has caught it during a flaring state. So the hope is that we can actually, by doing more multi-wavelength campaigns, we can actually try to catch some more of these flares and really understand what's going on here. Veritas has a campaign where it's triggering off of the GEV state of this object to try to see what's going on. So the other giant radio galaxy that's really neat is a Centaurus A picture, where this was shown before, and I should learn from the first presenter that this is not going to show up, but you see the giant radio lobe of Centaurus A compared to the full moon here. The cool thing about this is just really neat to me is that the LAT sees both the emission from the core and from the lobes. And you can zoom this in and really see how the LAT emission extends out from the center of the core detects. You can get really good spectra from both the northern southern lobe and the core itself. Plotted in this plot. And you can see how this is a very constant dominant. And the understanding here is that you have cosmic ray microwave background and UVL photons, inverse Compton emission out here. And since the inverse Compton emission is dominant, you mean that the B field is low in the lobes compared to other sources of this type. And what you can do with this is you can also study the EVL. But the main thing about this 11-month paper is that you can't really differentiate very well the models out here at the high energy. So what you really want to do is do a detailed analysis of full year data set and try to nail down the statistics and try to get some more energy bins out there and really understand what's going on. But this was shown in a presence talk down here at the bottom end. But here's a zoom in. The detection by Hess up here doesn't really match the LAT detection. This is kind of puzzling. You have to shift one of both of these to get them to match. FR1s are the parent population of blazars. You would expect kind of the same emission mechanisms to be able to explain both of the detections, but it's hard here. I mean, talking to people, it's kind of difficult to be able to model these. And so there's different ways we can think about.
This is not core, but
this is the core. The Hess measurements, I'm not sure they're centered on the core, is their detection. But the main thing here is that you can't really figure out a single emission mechanism to model these. So you think of different emission regions, different parent populations, and things like that. So then the prototypical radio galaxy observed in VHE is M87. This is the one we've been looking at for years now. And you have these beautiful radio images of M87 that you can zoom in and see the Chandra and the HST and the optical, and zoom in even further and see these wonderful movies of blobs and jets coming out. But the main thing is what we're trying to understand is when you look at this with the VHE instrument, you're looking at basically this whole region here, and we don't know where along the jet the VHE or the GAV emission is coming from. So we're trying to understand that by doing multi-wavelength campaigns and seeing if we can correlate some of these flares. And so the main thing for VHE here, out of all these categories, is that the only non-laser AGN detected by the previous generation of instruments was detected by Hegra at kind of a low significance level, which basically means that, yes, it is emitting. We knew it was a TEV emitter, but we didn't know much more about it. The other thing is that it's really close, so you don't have to worry about the EBL, and you can see those resolve structures in the radio, so you can try to pull out what's going on there. The LAT understanding is that you can model the MEV and GEV emission from this region here with the one-zone SST with a moderate jet moving, but this doesn't preclude any non-core emission because of the error circle here. You can see the LAT SED here along with some flaring states. And some low states from TEV instruments. In this plot, I just love this plot. This is 10 years of multi-wavelength campaigns on M87, showing you the VHE instruments. Starting in around 2008, you have Fermi coming online. You have Chandra from the 4, Chandra from the HST1 knot. You have the Hubble Space Telescope core and HST1 knot, and you have the radio measurements down here showing these flares in 2008. But the original 2005 flare, right here shown with the VHE, coincided with this X-ray and radio flare in the non-HST1. So the interpretation there was that the TEV emission was coming from that HST1 region about 120 parsecs from the core. But then, of course, looking at it again, you see something completely different. So you see this huge VHE flare here, seen both by MAGIC and Veritas, and this was up to about 10% of the crab. And then you can see here the X-ray emission is pretty much flat for HST1, but then the core increases here, as well as there's this radio emission coming from the core later on. So the conclusion from this is that at this point, we think that the TEV emission is coming from the core. And then you can also do fancy things with this, which are fun. Like, you can use that VHE light curve as a source function. Going the wrong way. You can use that VHE light curve as a source function and inject some electrons into a slow outer sheath of jet plasma. You can actually reproduce a nice radio light curve, assuming that you have the that you have some radio emitting plasma being optically thick at the beginning and then it thins out. So, and then recently in 2010, there was an even bigger flare. This is the biggest flare ever seen from M87 at VHE of 20% of the crab. That's this right here. And this has had multi-wavelength coverage as well. I don't believe it's around the time of the flare, but during the same epoch. But the main thing you can see here, and this goes back to what Manel was saying, that you see this gigantic flare in April of 2010 going up to 20% of the crab. And this, at 20% of the crab, we can get a 5 sigma detection in about 10 minutes to Veritas. So you can do fancy things like measuring the spectra of the rising peak, of the rising edge and the falling edge and the peak. And the differences in the spectral slopes here are about 2 sigma. So there, it looks like there's hints that the spectral index is changing as you're going up and down this flare in M87. So I think the final note of this is we just have to keep looking at it, and hopefully maybe we'll see two things happening the same way, but I don't hold out. These things have a habit of changing their stripes every time you look at them. But the main thing to take away is this flare seemed to coincide with this knot, this flare seemed to coincide with the core, and then this flare here, we're still analyzing it, but it looks like we've got enough statistics to try to be able to tell what's going on on modeling. But I think the main conclusions that I want to draw is that these highly variable objects need these really detailed multi-wavelength campaigns to really understand what's going on. And then the second thing I think is that if you look back to the previous generation of TEV instruments, we had a handful of VLACs, a handful of blazars we were detecting. And now we've got a lot of these things, and we're starting to do population studies of the VLACs and being able to use them as modeling them as a whole population. And I think when we get CTA in line, we're going to start detecting NGC 1275 in the low state and be able to get a really strong detection of SYN-A, not in a couple seasons of data, but in a month or two or three. And then hopefully detect M87 in a low state as well, where, like in 2009, where it wasn't seen by any of the major TV instruments. Thank you.
What's your efficiency with campaigning? That is, when you do campaigns, you do them on a single object?
That's how it's been in the past.
And then what fraction of those times nothing happened?
That's a hard question.
What we do with our campaigns within the Fermi is we do somewhere around 10 or a dozen objects so that you can essentially be guaranteed that a few of them will be going. Is that
you mean like with our campaigns in Fermi?
Yeah.
It's kind of similar where we have a list of objects we usually they have a constant really good about alerting us when they're firing. And we usually try to get on those within the night. And I would say probably 10% of them end up being bright TV, but that's just a number off the top of my head. It depends on what we're looking at the time and the observing program. But usually, so in a given 8-hour night, we'll observe 5 to 6 alerts. But it depends if we have one we're trying to hit really hard, we might observe 2 or 3, or if the weather's bad, we might look at 20 different random blazars that we're trying to just pull up.
Weather's bad might be your range.
Well, so we have what we call a B and C weather time, and then we have filler objects where we look at a list of blazars that we're just trying to catch in a flaring state, and not trying to do a detailed study of them like some of the other videos. Okay.
Genuinely, you cannot feel the
opposite. That would be like going from one to the next.
Okay.
Yeah. So we see M87 so close. How far do you think we can see it?
A source like M87?
Yeah.
I think we're at the edge of, with that bright flare, I think we could have seen that flare probably 2 or 3 times farther than it is now. But I mean, if you're trying to detect anything lower than that, it's going to be very different. I don't know. Benno, have you ever looked at that? I don't know.
There are not many other
kind of
flares that are
how many singular objects are there?
Yeah, I think I picked the three that are exciting.
Okay, thank you again.
Thank you.